Hello, dear listener. Editor JT here. If you're listening to this on the day it goes live for patrons, you have just 2 days left if you want to snag some of our limited-time merch. Whether you want Hakim's patented theory tote bag, Yugopnik snake eating its own ass, or our very patriotic Remember What You're Fighting For sweater, you've got until October 15th to order. Thank you all for your continued support, and now, on with the show.
I have something very important to tell you. I don't like chocolate. But
okay,
there's this what's it called, like cheapo, you know, like convenience store that I live by, and they have this. It's not a brand even. It literally just says, if I were to translate into to English, it literally just says hazelnuts chocolate, like hazelnuts dash chocolate in like a green pack.
Nice.
It is the most bootleg. Fuck. By the way, this costs like the equivalent of like 2 cents. It's a small. It's the size of your palm, maybe slightly less. Very, very cheap. And it is the kind of chocolate that if I were to give to anybody, they'd probably spit it out. But for some reason, this fucking arsenic chocolate, I will die for this shit.
So is it dark chocolate? Is it?
No, it's milk chocolate with hazelnuts. But I love the inconsistency because they don't specify if it's chopped or whole hazelnuts. But when you bite into it, sometimes it's a whole hazelnut. Sometimes they're chopped.
You never know what you're going to get.
I love that.
Yeah, it's probably made out of oil and cement.
Yeah, exactly, man. I'm sure they fucking temper this with mercury or something, goddamn. Jeez. But it's good. I like it.
Yeah, I'm not super big on chocolate, honestly. I like dark chocolate, but only like the milder dark chocolate. And that's about it.
I love chocolate, but when I eat it, it gives me massive headaches. So there's like a love-hate relationship with it.
Interesting.
It's like... Yeah. Especially dark chocolate. Dark chocolate is like straight to the brain, migraine for the rest of the day. So maybe I should try out some of that hazelnut.
the bootleg
hazelnut chocolate.
It doesn't have any chocolate in it and no cocoa. Yeah. That's maybe why you like it.
Yeah.
It's 20% rubber.
You haven't had chocolate in like 20 years and you try this and it only says it's chocolate, but it doesn't taste like chocolate and you don't remember what chocolate tastes like. You're like, oh my God, I actually like this thing, but it actually is a chocolate. The plot twist. And I don't like sweets in general. Like I have like 2 cakes dying in my fridge from different birthdays or whatever that mostly my partner went to, but I don't touch that shit. And especially like on a night out or like a nice dinner out, I don't get dessert because it's like, this is, I don't know, Hakim is now gonna shit on me, but this is like unwritten like Slavic code of like when you drink, you do not consume anything with processed sugars because like that makes it even worse in your fucking stomach and you have an even worse like hangover. So kids listening, number one, don't drink, but if you have to, don't actually drink sodas with your fucking shit. Like hydrate next to your booze.
Make a base in your stomach. Don't drink. First of all, don't drink. Period. But if you have to, don't drink on an empty stomach.
If you're contractually obligated as a Slav,
exactly. If it comes part of the culture, then yeah. How about you, Charlie? Are you a big soda mixing alcohol fan, or
my go-to drink is usually some sort of tequila with some soda water and a little bit of the old lime. That's the
beautiful. Oh, nice.
Yeah, that's what I'll order at a bar if I'm
you like the burn. Is
exactly. Yeah, I need to taste the alcohol in order to know how much I'm drinking. Like literally anything with like copious amounts of sugar in it, next day I'm waking up and it's bad news.
It's chemistry.
An eco-terrorist.
Exactly.
Back like 3,000 years ago, obviously our ancestors didn't know it was chemistry or that, I mean, they didn't have Coca-Cola, okay? They couldn't consume as much sugar even if they tried. maybe in a year as much as we get from a soda can. But it's interesting how, you know, these sorts of like things that people just figured out because they like poisoned themselves in 50 different ways. And like, oh, this poison is milder, so I should do this and this, figured it out. And now, because technology has advanced enough for us to actually find the root cause of these, like sometimes just, you know, traditional approaches to leading a relatively healthier life, we find out finally why. But speaking of like traditional versus modern versus what we consume and so on, and relevant to the lovely guest that we have now, what are you guys' let's do the lib thing and like blame ourselves for climate change change. What are you guys' like most, let's call them, climate damaging activities that you do very regularly and kind of sometimes feel bad about it, sometimes not, but sometimes something that, you know, is on repeat, but you're not the proudest of. Let's share.
Hmm.
I consume meat, but I don't feel bad about it. Sorry.
I did an AMA the other day, or I guess not really an AMA, but on Hexbear community. Shout out to Hexbear people. They're all very sweet. Mm. But that's the only... I think it's happened both times. Like, there will be a question from a vegan, and they mean very well. But they just get so aggressive so quickly. I'm like, well, you know, I understand the position. I'm not personally vegan. I just get roasted. I'm like, I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm sorry.
The
I'm
escalation trying. is quick when it comes to revealing that you eat meat.
Yeah. I'm such a picky boy. I have a child's palate as it is. Now you expect me to eat plant fibers?
Yeah, you're trying to eat that pepperoni pizza every day.
I know.
Imagine if Dr. Pepper wasn't...
Oh. Look, if I could get all of my nutrients from Dr. Pepper, I would go back on Dr. Pepper, and I could consist off of that, I think.
Wow. Your drug of choice.
Yeah. I'm 8 months clean, though. I'm good.
Wow.
Bravo, 8 months. GG, my friend. Yeah.
We'll make it. We'll make it a coin on the
frontier. Dr. Pepper clean.
But you know, Charlie. Yeah. What about you? What's your?
I feel like for me, I just live far away from my family, so it's just flying to go see them. Mm. So it's like, you know, I feel like flying is seen as such a dirty act, but it's required if I want to hang out with my family and be with the people I love. So it's this. You know, maybe we'll talk about this a little later, but just, you know, this self-hatred and guilt of doing something that you know is bad, but in reality, you know, the reason why it's bad is perhaps because fossil fuel companies tell us it's bad.
That's why you fly with the knotted rope, right? And you're carry-on, so you can stand up in the aisle and flagellate yourself.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. I'm walking down the aisles, flagellating.
Sneak on to planes.
You guys need to send another 600 million to Zelensky or something. I don't know. That's why you can't have high speed rail.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's why you can't. You know, no maglevs for you. I'm sorry. The bridges have to collapse, especially in and around the black communities.
Yeah. Stuff a little sure it's a coincidence. Yeah.
Christ. The train system in the U.S. is so so abysmal. Sometimes I live in Chicago, and when I go home to New York, I take the train, which is like it's like a 24-hour adventure that could turn into a maybe 30 to 35-hour adventure, depending on, you know, how delayed the Amtrak wants to be. It's a wild ride and super boring, but that's the price you gotta pay in this beautiful country of
the wealthiest country of
three
exist,
corporations in a trench coat. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Oh, I would give anything for a nice maglev train to speed 5 hours to New York.
That would be cool. Oh, man, that would be so cool.
A dream of the day.
Wasn't that the top speed of the like Shanghai Beijing fast rail, 600 kilometers an hour or something insane like that?
Oh shit. Yeah.
They're getting really fast.
I'm gonna check that hole.
Yeah, look it up.
Let's see. 431 kilometers per hour. Fuck.
Wow.
Speed. Oh my god.
Yeah, the one that we just made, you know, our quote-unquote high-speed rail is slower than the one that somebody produced in, like,
the 50s. Japan had it 50 years ago.
It's like, come on, man.
They are trying to, like, I feel like there's a plan for Houston and, like, I don't, some area around those metropolises. They're going to try to, like, take Japanese tech and just, like, put it down, but... You know, we'll see. We'll see about that. We'll see about that.
That remains to be seen. I'll believe it when it's there.
Exactly.
Alas. And then we're going to have the tracks just buckle in the Texas heat. And just melt.
Mine is much simpler. And it makes no sense. Plastic bags. I have a whole three drawers filled with like 300 plastic bags, and I always take a plastic bag when I'm shopping, and I just put it in the drawer. But then I put all my trash in like the plastic bags from the shops, right? So yeah. I don't buy one of those like massive like black bags that they fill with trash. I always reuse the shopping bag that I used at the store. But I have never purchased, and I probably will not because I don't want to, because they never remember. And also I read some statistics that if you buy like those cloth ones, it's like 50,000 plastic ones or whatever the fuck. So I go to the store with empty hands and I just get a couple of bags there, and then I use those bags to throw out. But obviously at one point they start piling up, and continuing my conversation from before about classic Slavic traditions, having 3-4 drawers in your kitchen just filled with plastic bags is an absolute classic, which I do not endorse, but I am a part of that particular problem, I guess. What is fair though, gift bags. When you get a gift in a gift bag, save the gift bag, reuse the gift bag for some person whose birthday you're going to or whatever the fuck. They're not really going to notice that you reused it. So that's how I balance out my plastic bag consumption.
Wait, I want to back up a little bit. Did you say that you reuse the little plastic bags and you put all of your trash in it? So do you have like lots of little bags of trash like scattered around your house?
No, I just put them in my trash can, just compared to you Yanks who produce so much trash.
Do you have a very small trash can? Like how many liters would you say your trash can is, or like where does it, like if you stood next to it, where does it reach up your leg? How high does it go?
Below my ankle?
Below your ankle? Wait, that is not a, that's like a cat litter bin. Like what are you talking about?
Yeah, bin. Yeah, that's my bin. I put shit in my bin and then I throw it out. Yeah. How much trash do you create? Yeah.
I mean,
like what? Three pieces from bananas and like like leftover like organic waste from food, and I don't know, 2-3 plastic packagings from like also food. That's it. So, and I throw it out the next day. That's it.
It's shallow, but like it's like a square or something. Like normally.
Yeah, you press it with your foot and it opens up, you know, phew, you know, those ones.
Oh.
That are just on the ground. I mean, I integrated into my kitchen, and when I open the door, it opens. But yeah, it's not that big. And I just put the shopping bag inside of it, and then I fill it.
Like, I'm standing up. I'm just standing up and looking down at where my ankles are compared to the floor. I'm like,
sorry, no, not ankles. What the fuck?
Knee?
What do you call the knee, the thing? Yeah, the knee. Not ankles. So oh, God, no. Oh, my God, ankles. I was like, what the fuck? That's not that. It's a fucking
I was like, you're using a small tray.
Oh, God. Oh, Lord.
A plate.
Your company just doesn't have the lower parts of his legs. They just have ankles. Apologies.
Oh, man.
But yeah, a normal bin. Yeah, it's just a bin.
Okay, all right. Well, I'm glad we resolved that, because I was having an existential crisis there trying to figure out if our trash cans are truly that horrific, or if you're just very...
tiny boy.
I don't know how you made that work. You couldn't fit a McDonald's bag in anyway.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
All right. Howdy, y'all. Welcome back to the Deprogram. This is episode 101. Feels like a new start coming back after our very wholesome episode 100. If you haven't listened to that, go and smile for 2 hours. Good God, that took me so long to edit. Anyway, today we have with us a very special guest. We have Charlie from Our Changing Climate. He does video essays on climate change and consumption, culture, things like that. Coming up on 500,000 subscribers now. But we wanted to, one thing also that I have to mention is your thumbnails, Charlie, are some of the most appealing thumbnails I've ever seen. They're just, they stand out in my subscription feed, and it's just so nice. Anyway, I hate
doing thumbnails. Oh, shucks. I feel like I stumbled across that, like,
it looks so
a long
good.
Time
clean.
Ago.
Oh, it's clean.
I was doing a minimalism video, and I was like, "Oh, this kind of looks pretty good."
This kind of slaps.
And then I continued it on. Anyway, so I'm Charlie. I run the YouTube channel Our Changing Climate. It's about to be 7 years of making YouTube videos. I've kind of, it's interesting, the channel originally started back in 2016, and it was like, I didn't have a job, and I was like, I don't know what to do. And I was feeling kind of frustrated with the lack of conversation on like YouTube about climate. I couldn't like find any videos about climate change that weren't from like the BBC or, you know, PBS or something like that. And so I was like, okay, I might as well just like learn how to make YouTube videos and like in the process, like continue researching and like learning about these like crucial environmental topics. And at the start, it was kind of like, a lot of my videos were very, you know, the typical liberal approach to environmentalism. And I was also doing a lot of media analysis too. But then, yeah, during the pandemic, I was like, I started radicalizing. It was kind of like a slow process. As you dig deeper into like climate literature and like, you know, environmental issues, you run up against this thing called capitalism that always seems to be at the bottom of a lot of these crises.
Blame everything with capitalism. Got that. Different podcasts.
Yeah, get down in the comments. Get down in the comments. I was kind of running into capitalism, but the solutions that were kind of being put forward, at least from, you know, some of the stuff that I was reading, was like, we just need to like subsidize a bunch of electric cars and build out renewables. Like, I don't know, Joe Biden is going to save us. And that kind of didn't feel appropriate for the task. And so, yeah, I went down the slope of diving into the kind of how do we actually dismantle and destroy capitalism? How do we build something new? And, you know, looking at real life examples of what happened, you kind of inevitably go towards socialism and communism. So, so yeah, that's me. That's our changing climate, the brief history.
That tracks pretty closely with how my channel developed, actually, too. We started right around the same time. I was working at Best Buy, and I was, you know, I was miserable there, and I hated everybody and hated my job. Did a brief stint in inside sales, which was the worst decision I've ever made. And it was during that period in inside sales, after they fired the person who was training me, and I was just left to my own devices. I was like, this isn't sustainable. And I had like a small YouTube channel that I had been working on a little bit while I was at Best Buy, because a buddy of mine, Joseph from Real Life Lore, had started a channel, and he was seeing some success. And I was like, I'm probably a better editor than Joseph. I bet I can do that. So I started it, and you know, I kind of put my nose to the grindstone when I was working at that sales place. And I had one video that took off pretty well. I'm like, okay, I'm just going to assume the rest of my videos are also going to do well. I quit. And that was a terrible decision in retrospect. Like, I would not recommend anybody do that, but thankfully it worked out. But then, yeah, I was doing all sorts of, you know, general interest. Oh, what if there was a black hole the size of whatever and stuff like that. But then, the pandemic rolled around and the horrible U.S. response to it, I kind of snapped as well. And I was like, all right, time to do some stuff that actually matters. And the rest is history. So it sounds like you had a kind of a similar come to Jesus moment about what your channel needs to do.
Yeah, I think it was partly the pandemic and also partly just, I think for a while, it's interesting. Like, I feel like, yeah, sometimes it can be scary to talk about the big C, big capitalism, like to such a broad audience, both because you'll get backlash from the right and also from the left. Because I wasn't sure, you know, whether I knew like enough to talk about it. But, you know, I was like, eventually I was like, all right, well, whatever. I like, this is how I feel. So
yeah,
I want to kind of learn at least voice it. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Which is cool. Then your audience kind of grows with you as you learn more, and then you can share more with them. And I think it's a pretty cool experience and a decent way to do it. Anyway, all that aside, history aside, can you give us a very brief rundown of the history of climate science? When did we first realize that there was a problem that was actually pretty existential?
Yeah, So the very, a difficult question to summarize very quickly, but there's really kind of two or three kind of important periods. One is that like we really first discovered that climate change is a thing or like a possibility in like the 1850s. A woman named Eunice Foote discovered that carbon dioxide could like trap heat and cause the greenhouse effect. And she was like, this could be a thing later on in the future, so we might want to watch out. And she was, her findings until recently were kind of buried because she was a woman in science. Inevitably, some other man was like, oh, I actually figured this out first. But so that's kind of like when we first knew it could be a thing. And then skip forward to like the 1960s, 1970s. You start to see this kind of a rising consensus among scientists that climate change is not only a possibility, but is happening, and that fossil fuel emissions were to blame. So we knew as early as the 1960s, we were already on the path to going into some deep shit. And then like 1990s rolls around and there's like very, very solid consensus that climate change is here. It's caused by fossil fuel emissions, and that we really need to start dealing with it. And so you get like the Kyoto conference, which is kind of the first global conference of government bodies and states trying to figure out what the hell to do about climate change. But that's kind of like the trajectory of it. It's interesting, you know, like a lot of the research in the 70s and 80s was partly fueled by fossil fuel companies like Exxon. Like they retrofitted their fuel barge into like a climate change research like super barge, and they were doing like a ton of research and trying to figure out what was happening in order to like inevitably figure out how to stop the research from exploding into the media. But so fossil fuel giants were like kind of at the cutting edge of climate change research for a while, and they were finding that what they were doing was not good and was causing this kind of, you know, emissions crisis, this climate change we're now feeling quite acutely.
Well, I definitely want to touch on Exxon in a little bit, but before we get to that, just so everyone is on the same page, because I know a lot of people don't really engage with the specifics of what we're facing because, you know, either it's too depressing or it doesn't feel immediately relevant to their life. So we know climate change is happening and it sounds serious, but like how serious are we talking? I think to a lot of people, it probably just seems like summers are a little bit hotter than usual, or you might have a heat wave, or that, you know, might have an extra forest fire if you live in Colorado or something. Can you give us some examples of the kind of fallout we're facing?
Yeah, basically the fallout we're facing is, you can kind of see it in like hurricanes, droughts, more severe like heat waves, all those things. Like Hurricane Maria, for example, decimated Puerto Rico, or Hurricane Harvey. I'm sure you. It's almost like I think a way to describe it is an analogy that I don't really like because I'm not a baseball fan, but I think is pretty apt. Climate change is kind of like a baseball player who's on steroids. Like you can't really like point out one single home run to their use of steroids, but the total trend of their, you know, miraculous 700 home runs over the season, you can look at that and be like, okay, that is definitely because of steroids. And in the same way, climate change is basically the steroids of our weather systems and all of these kind of intense events that we're seeing. So Hurricane Maria, Hurricane Harvey, back a year ago, there was massive floods in Pakistan that over like 1,700 people died because of these floods that were exacerbated by more rains, higher sea levels, et cetera. Mm. I feel like every single month, getting like September, for example, was the hottest ever. September on record. And I feel like every single month we're getting this news update. Oh, yeah, October, hottest month, you know, November, et cetera. So these kind of things, it can be kind of like, it can feel world shattering almost.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that is kind of what we're feeling now. But the scary part is that we are on track for a much worse future. Not to be all doom and gloom, but unfortunately, the science and the projections are not great. Basically, there's this body called the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or the IPCC, which is...
Lizards. Like evil scientists. Yeah. Don't want me to have a big truck!
Exactly. Yeah. They control everything, and they're the reason why we're in this problem in the first place. So, yeah, it's like 700 scientists in just under like 100 countries. So it is the source for climate change info. And honestly, it's a bit conservative because they have to go through so many processes to appease so many different countries and parties.
Yeah, I've seen that. Reading some of their documents, it's like they come right up to the edge of saying this is because of capitalism, but they just kind of have to back down just a little bit. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, it's super interesting. I feel like their language is that we need like rapid, immediate, and drastic cuts, and we need systemic change. It seems like some of the authors are like trying to sneak something in there about capitalism, but haven't quite yet been able to sneak it past. But yeah, so the projections are basically that with our current policies, we're on track for 3.2 degrees Celsius of warming by 2100.
Jeez.
Right now, we're like hovering around 1 degree Celsius. And it's not like 1 degree Celsius of warming. Like, it kind of gets exponentially worse as you go up in degrees. Or not exponentially, but...
significantly, it ramps.
Yeah. And because as you go higher in degrees, you start setting off tipping points like permafrost melting that hasn't melted in hundreds or thousands of years, and that releases methane into the air that then warms the earth even more, and it kind of like there's these spirals that can, you know, be set off as we reach these thresholds. So 3.2 degrees of warming is with current policies. So that's like with the Paris Agreement. That's if everyone says and does what they say they were going to do, which is kind of scary, especially considering that like even right now, climate change and like these intensified hurricanes and intensified droughts we're experiencing right now are extremely deadly. So as we get warmer and warmer, that's just going to get worse. And that is like, that's like kind of the average projection. There's also scenarios where it could get up to like 4.4 degrees Celsius of warming. It's not great, I will say that. And I think that like part of it is that there's sometimes it can get like a little hard to talk about because it feels like the scope of the problem is obviously global and everything needs to happen perfectly in order to get to those scenarios where the IPCC says we can stay below 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming.
But okay, you said global. So, you know, I am not as close to the equator. You're telling me 3 degrees, 4 degrees. Okay, fuck this guy. Like, this is not going to reach me, whatever the fuck. What would you tell, obviously, these malinformed people, including not only, I guess, the direct, because people usually, even if they understand the environmental impact, which includes literally nature changing and fucking murdering you at some point, or not letting you have pretty much anything to eat or to survive in the particular climate that you're in, but they don't understand just how consequential that can be for society as a whole and can create many different social and economic problems that will then eventually impact you. I don't know, Josh from Frankfurt, even though Germany is a bad example because what, like a year ago, like a whole town disappeared in a flood.
Yeah.
But what would you tell the people that say, okay, most likely like the physical aspect of climate disaster is not going to hit me and they don't give a fuck about it?
I think everyone is going to get hit by some form of climate disaster shock, whether that's like, you know, physically, you know, in a flood or, you know, drought, but also like in terms of like food security, yields have consistently gone down over the last century as a result of warming. And it will only get worse as we see kind of shifts in weather and climate as monsoon seasons change and farmers are kind of unable to keep on with their plan that they've known for hundreds of years. It has now drastically changed. Weather patterns will disrupt food yields and so on. So I think that when you look at a city where someone might say I live in Chicago, for example, and I feel like there's this new thing where cities kind of in the Midwest US are we are a climate haven and people should move here because, you know, we're not close to the ocean. We're not close to any hurricane zones. Drought probably won't be an issue. And same thing with Buffalo was it'll get warmer, so it'll be fine. But we see in each of those instances, Buffalo last winter had the biggest snowstorm on record that was caused by a changing climate. And so I think it's a global climate affects everything. It's it's almost this. I feel I'm in a matrix where I'm putting yarns everywhere and pins on a bulletin board.
But you're at the blinds. Am I crazy?
Well, there are so many knock-on effects. So one place is particularly susceptible to flooding, say the Marshall Islands. I went and shot a documentary there. They're going underwater. Those people all have to move somewhere. So they move somewhere. Yeah. And then you suddenly have this tension of if they come to somewhere in the United States, there's going to be this racism. There's going to be this aggression towards immigrants, or Germany. They don't particularly care for immigrants at the moment. So things like that, where you've got migration patterns that have been fairly predictable and stable for, X number of years, are now rapidly changing. And so we're having to grapple with the movements of human populations, as well as the destruction of places where people have lived for centuries, as well as you no longer can predict the amount of food you'll be able to produce in any given location. Will you be able to feed all these new people that have come to this location? So you've got a stress on the supply chain. There are all these little...
We invaded motherfucking countries for dead dinosaurs, okay? Yeah. For oil. Yeah. What do you think countries are going to do when there's not enough food, brother? The most water cliche, basic argument.
And I feel like... We know that also that a hotter world, just being in hot environments, increases people's propensity to, or, the probability that conflicts will spark. And those conflicts, as JT just said, will spark other conflicts elsewhere as, migration happens and refugees inevitably come out of conflict. So, it's all encompassing.
All right, so let's turn back to some of the people that are responsible for this. So you mentioned Exxon. So they buried the data that they found. You can go online and find, dear listener, you can find the documents, the internal documents that Exxon had produced and give them a read yourself. You can see their projections. They're pretty accurate. It's honestly quite impressive for the time, if a little conservative. But then they launched the most comprehensive corporate propaganda campaign in history. So to what extent would you say large corporations play a role in shaping the conversation, the climate conversation today?
Yeah. I mean, they're pretty much running the show. And goodbye, I'll see you later. I feel like they're almost in every stage of how we approach climate action and climate change. So, as you just said, they not only had research and buried it, but they've also have run an extensive campaign to shroud and obfuscate the data around climate change and make it kind of essentially muddy the debate and make sure people think that the consensus is not actually a consensus and that the climate science is still up for debate. Mm. And they did that through so many different vectors. They primarily, one of them was literally buying out space in newspapers like the New York Times and writing fake editorials.
Jeez.
Telling people that this is actually, The climate science is like a little more up in the air, and maybe it's actually like kind of an individual problem, and that like the way that you can solve it is by recycling a little bit more, like, you know, cutting down on your carbon footprint. So ExxonMobil, alongside like people like BP, who literally that they are the ones who popularize the idea of the carbon footprint.
Mm-hmm.
When you think of like a carbon footprint, it's probably because BP had a campaign back in like the mid-2000s, essentially saying like, you should pay attention to your own little carbon footprint. And
not ours, yeah. Not the military's,
exactly.
Yeah.
And
that was like an actual campaign. It wasn't something that capitalism just by itself kind of introduced because, you know, the market for eco-friendly products erupted and so on. That was planned out and pitched to the masses by corporate think tanks, basically, which is fucking insane, right? That's what you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah, there's like, you can go on YouTube and type in BP carbon footprint campaign, and there's like the commercial there.
Yeah, yeah.
What size is your carbon footprint?
The carbon footprint's there. That I don't know.
Whatever it is, the whole population of the world, make that a very, very big number.
How much carbon I produce? Is that it?
You mean the effect that my living has on the earth in terms of the products I consume?
And there's like a ton of they ran these like posters that were like, check out our carbon footprint calculator, or like, here's how you help. This was in the era of the Beyond Petroleum marketing campaign, where they were like, oh, we're gonna go green and like save the earth, when in reality they weren't doing anything. Yeah, so a lot of like ExxonMobil's and BP and all these kind of fossil fuel giants have spent so much money and decades of, you know, marketing and behind the scenes tinkering to reframe the problem from fossil fuel industry, the extraction of fossil fuels, the production of fossil fuels, to the individual consumption of fossil fuels. Perhaps flying is the problem. Your one thing that you're doing, which is very hard to change because of the fossil fuel industry pervading every single aspect of our life, is somehow the problem. So they basically set up a victim blaming scheme on a grand scale.
Holy shit.
And they, yeah. Yeah.
And it's been very effective too. I mean, if you go to the comments on any video where you talk about this stuff as like a systemic issue, people are like, yeah, that's bad, but if we all vote with our dollar, you know, we can change this. Like, man, that's not how it works. This is exactly what they want you to think.
The dollar made like that idea of we want to fuck.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, Lord.
Yeah. It feels like it is a conspiracy. I mean, it's like, I feel like sometimes I'm like, how is this like, it just feels so deep and pervasive that like I even though like I make videos about it all the time, I'm walking around in my daily life and I like feel it. I like have internalized that, you know, my actions, my individual action of like, you know, buying this with my dollar or this with my dollar will somehow ripple out and change the world. So yeah, in that sense, these large corporations are very much shaping the climate conversation. In addition, they have so many seats at all tables of kind of the big conferences around climate change, specifically like the Conference of Parties, which is, or COP, as it's known.
But that's like calling a Nazi to a Holocaust memorial. Like, what the fuck?
Yeah. It is. The Conference of Parties is basically a sham now because it literally, I was just reading this morning that apparently in, I think it was the 2023 or 2021 COP, over 500 fossil fuel delegates or like lobbyists were there kind of like schmoozing with everyone else. There's so much bleed from the fossil fuel industry into the people that are making these so-called global solutions to this climate crisis. So yeah, when you ask like, are large corporations shaping the conversation? Yeah, they're basically in every single little piece, every little nook and cranny, they're there. it can sometimes feel insurmountable to deal with all of those aspects of how much they're muddying the waters and how much they're controlling the conversation about what we actually should be doing.
You mentioned solutions just there. And that's something that I would like to talk about, because obviously the stuff that we're being proposed are not real solutions. They're kind of band-aids at best. Mm-hmm. So that begs the question, what do we do? And you made a video recently about industrial sabotage in the name of climate action. And obviously this kind of conversation is completely hypothetical.
Hypothetical.
Yeah. But could you tell us a little bit more about that? What's the thinking there? Yeah, hypothetically in Minecraft.
Yeah. So, you know, hypothetically, if we're talking hypotheticals here, basically, like, to understand perhaps why we hypothetically might need some sort of industrial sabotage, you kind of have to, like, dig into fossil fuels' role in capitalism and mm-hmm. why it's so crucial to this whole economic system that we live under. Because fossil fuels are used in every sector of this economy. Primarily, it's because, you know, if you look at that good old formula, you know, money, commodity, money, basically fossil fuels are getting channeled right into that C part or the commodity part. They are crucial for the production of anything. And so when you want to change something about fossil fuels, when you want to ideally draw down and abolish this fossil fuel system, that is not only like an existential threat to the BPs and the Exxons, but it's also an existential threat to like so many other industries that are kind of built on the consumption of fossil fuels. And basically, you have this fossil fuel industry that is extracting and selling off their fuels for profit. And up until now, we've kind of, the main approach has been these mass marches in the streets and calling on governments to build renewables and declare climate emergencies. All things that certainly are essential, but in the last 50 years, we haven't really seen any moving of the needle. So at some point, you have to stop and think, at what point do we need to start escalating tactics? At what point do we need to realize, okay, we have a limited amount of time. Right now we're like about 90% of the way towards a 1.5 degree mark. We've emitted 90% of the things we can, or emitted 90% of fossil fuels or carbon dioxide we're allowed to if we are to stay below 1.5 degrees. So we have about like 5-6 years left to stay below that degree threshold. So time is short. And if we keep on doing what we've done, history tells us that it won't be fast enough. So you kind of have to ask yourself, hypothetically, what do you need to do in order to hit fossil fuels where they care about? That's where industrial sabotage comes in. And there's a great little book called How to Blow Up a Pipeline by Andreas Malm. And he essentially proposes that in addition to these mass movements, we might need to start making the fixed assets or these, you know, pipelines, these, you know, oil derricks, these natural gas extraction points. We might need to make them not profitable for fossil fuel industries to convince them that what they're doing is not sustainable. Not in the sense of like not sustainable for the environment, but like not sustainable for them, like for their bottom line.
Right.
Because we have seen that like fossil fuel companies will only care about their bottom line. That means hypothetically, like welding pipeline valves shut or monkey wrenching. And it's important to note that this is a small portion of a larger movement.
Right. Needs to be organized. It can't just be like vigilante nonsense.
Exactly. And there's an idea called like the radical flank effect. Mm-hmm. And that like through like this kind of seemingly more extreme or like more escalated tactic, the solutions or like, you know, the actual like the strategies of the broader global climate movement perhaps will seem more reasonable. There's a lot of interesting things around what's happening with the climate movement. I think right now it feels a little, everything feels disjointed in some ways because climate change affects so many different things, sectors or areas of our life, that there's such a broad range of responses or visions of what climate action could be.
Right.
So like we're seeing some of this like escalation of like throwing soup on paintings, for example.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I think that like there's that great energy there, but it's, to me, it feels like there is an almost missed opportunity there as well, because what that's doing is raising awareness about climate change. There seems to be this emphasis on like these dramatic acts to say that like we need to raise awareness, or we need to call upon our, you know, our state actors to do something. And the idea behind industrial sabotage is that instead of throwing soup on paintings, you are directly dismantling the thing that is causing this crisis, which is fossil fuel production and extraction.
With all that being said, you know, the seeming insurmountability of the challenge, just the massive power of the corporations, everything we're up against, how optimistic are you about the possibility of curbing, if not all, at least, you know, the worst effects of climate change? Has that ship sailed? Do we still have a chance to at least brace for impact?
The age-old question.
Yeah.
I think for me, it really depends on the day. You know, especially like, you know, depending on the news you read. I think sometimes I am optimistic or hopeful because this is like, the climate crisis is a crisis, and in deep crisis, there's immense opportunity for change. I think that like, maybe I am just in an echo chamber of, you know, this like, the people coming to me are kind of recognizing the need for something more than just
empty gestures.
Empty gestures. Yeah, exactly. So in that sense, I'm optimistic in that like climate change is this massive crisis that touches everyone, and that the worse it gets, the more rowdy people will get.
Yeah.
The more like eager for change, eager for, you know, a revolution, for, you know, the toppling of a system that is causing it, the more eager they will be for that is sometimes what I think. And then, you know, some days I look at this deep crisis and, you know, see that crisis also provides opportunities for all, you know, all ends of the political spectrum. So, and we're seeing like, you know, the rise of eco-fascists and fossil fascism, and this potential that instead of reacting with this kind of like mass movement from below, there's instead this hyper-nationalist racist reaction from the top. And we're seeing that like just recently Alternatives for Deutschland, the kind of far right party in Germany, just won a bunch of their elections in some sectors of Germany, and they are like, they are the people that are like, we need brown coal in these. They've like they've kind of campaigned on like coal as like a national product. And we're, you know, we're seeing Trump, Jair Bolsonaro, people that are kind of like the inklings of what could be, what could proliferate under a climate crisis, where countries and nations close off their borders, protect the homeland from everyone else who is suffering under a changed and like burning world. So those are like kind of the two things that I constantly have in my head.
The two wolves inside you, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. They're just nipping at my heels.
Yeah.
So I mean, to answer, do we still have a chance to brace for impact, and has the ship sailed? No. And well, has the ship sailed? Definitely not. I feel like the thing with climate change is that it doesn't just like stop after we warm to 3.2 degrees or 1.5 degrees. As long as we emit fossil fuels and we keep burning coal, et cetera, the climate will just continue to warm.
Right.
So it will never sail. The ship will never sail. There will always be a necessity to kind of completely end the burning of fossil fuels and completely draw down emissions. Do we still have a chance to brace for impacts? Yes. I mean, I think that like adaptation, unfortunately, right now is a necessity. The people getting hit the hardest by changed climate are marginalized and oppressed people. And so adaptation is not only like a nice to have, but is crucial for preventing mass death.
I don't know who said it. You will watch climate change unfold on video online,
yeah,
until you're the one recording the video. It's a bit of a cliche at this point on Twitter, but
yeah,
it's
still
very
it gives
good.
Me goosebumps every time, and it's true. Yeah. Like with the New York one, I was like, man, that's. I've got friends in New York that are like, you know, recording stuff on their phones, and just like, wow, okay, yeah, it's accurate. That's an accurate statement. Anyway, so grim, alarming, but. The fact that we do still have an opportunity to do things about it, we do still have a chance to make the most of the situation, is good. So now let's talk a little bit more concretely.
Yeah.
What do you think it would take to ensure a livable future for humanity and for countless other species that are also at risk? What are some concrete steps we could take to make that possible?
Mm. Just a series of bleeps.
Yeah, I'd be curious to know what you all think, because I feel like this is to say that I know all the answers.
Nobody
would
knows.
I feel like I don't really know, but I think, you know, kind of what I'm making a bunch of these videos, it feels like I'm kind of landing on the idea that, one, we need immediate short term or, you know, immediate things that we can do right now to kind of reduce the harm of climate change. And in the process of kind of achieving those things, we need to work towards long-term goals of socialism and the idea of degrowth, which I think degrowth is interesting. I think I'm still wrestling with it as a concept, mainly because I feel like it's so amorphous.
I would literally ask you how you would define it, or maybe not you, how like people in let's call it your sector.
In the degrowth sector. So I think degrowth is basically the idea that we need a democratically planned economic contraction so that everyone in the world can live a good ecological life. Some people see degrowth as like, you know, this thing that we could potentially do under capitalism, you know, just shorten work hours and like give everyone like free public transit.
Yeah.
Which are things that like I think are very good and should happen.
Yeah, it's like it wouldn't hurt. It just goes against the degrowth entire, like as a whole, it goes against the prime directive of capitalism, which is endless growth on a finite planet, you know, the accumulation of capital. So they kind of butt heads at some point.
Yeah. So I think what I feel like capitalism is, this endless accumulation of goods, this endless production of stuff. And that is untenable. In a world where there is finite resources, as JT just said. So you need something. Degrowth can't just like stand alone. It needs this kind of planned economy based in worker or peasant control over the means of production. And I think that like, you know, the focus on the production of goods for use rather than exchange is crucial in kind of developing some sort of ecological world. But, you know, these things are like so big.
Yeah.
It's not enough, obviously, for some sort of like ecological socialism to arise in like one country. It has to happen like everywhere, which feels super daunting, especially considering like the state of the left currently. And I think I would also note that like degrowth has to have a focus on reparations and repair of kind of imperial plunder of the periphery. So like it cannot look like everyone just getting new efficient electric cars that are built through the mining of cobalt in the Democratic Republic of Congo, which is kind of what's currently happening. It can't just be like, oh, here is this brand new, shiny, electrified U.S. at the expense of like the imperial plunder of
repeat of the outsourcing industry and, you know, advanced consumer economies approach to finding cheap labor outside of its territory in order to keep producing the profit-generating product that it sells domestically. Which, you know, resources are... obviously, resources are a problem because, as you said beautifully, we live on a planet where there are finite. But additionally, an even bigger problem is the inadequate distribution of said resources, which currently do not only, like, people tend to think, okay, maybe somebody, like, you know, 20 people have as much money as 50% of people on the planet. But okay, you know, these are only digits in the bank, et cetera, et cetera. But no, my friend, in order for them to generate such astronomical profits, they engage in massive industrial, very often completely unnecessary overproduction through the elimination, directly or indirectly, or in Minecraft, of the capitalist class. You will immediately lower unnecessary extra production from the circulation of the international economy. So in a way, like, socialism de facto has this aspect of degrowth, be it they call it ecological and do it like proactively, or just as an indirect consequence of the restructuring of how the economy is run. But then obviously, if a socialist movement attaches to itself additionally as a obvious fucking aspect of, you know, a dialectical materialist analysis of the world, if they attach the love towards our climate, our environment, and our gorgeous, gorgeous planet, the more the merrier and the better this, in this case, state-run economy would be, because it will, you know, count in for those additional factors. But all I'm saying is that even if for some reason, which I can't imagine, but even if they are doing it for coming from a different place when creating a particular socialist economy, the direct consequence of creating such an economy will be the lowering of the massive impact that we have as a species on our particular environment. So win-win-win, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. I couldn't have said it better myself. What do you all think is...
Yeah, I mean, obviously, if you trace back the beginnings of the problem, you come to the Industrial Revolution, you come to the growth of capitalism, and all of the tendrils that it has since shot out, all of its little evil children. But it could be any number of things, like that because it's such a broad problem, there are so many things we could do. This is, you know, with the assumption that we've gotten rid of capitalism as it currently exists. It could be, you know, in somewhere like the United States, where we have a real problem with emissions from cars, because we don't have public transportation. We could return to super block style housing, where you have everything you need, an entire community based in one kind of building group with a green space and then a transport hub right outside. So you walk from your home to the train station and you get on the train and you go to work wherever you work, hop off, come back home. And you've got all your shopping there, you've got daycare there, you've got all these things taken care of. It is a brilliant model for housing and transportation. And like, there are some people, like architect, like fancy architects, who are starting to dabble in this idea, and they're like, you know, it's really crazy that this has never been done before. So we're kind of innovating here. It's like, no, you're not. This has been done in the past, and there's a reason for it. But there, you know, little things like that, I think, you know, it's not little. It would take tremendous expense and planning and stuff, but it would go a long way in somewhere like the United States. You've been talking about economic planning. We had a good conversation with a guy named Tomas Herdin, and he works in like cybernetic planning, and it's fascinating. We've got an episode on it. I think it's really good, investing in that and exploring how our modern technology can aid in the planning and distribution of resources, I think would be incredibly valuable.
In general, I think you guys had so many good points. The only way to stop the rapid decline, we are already in the rapid decline, but to at least halt it at some level, is, well, as you already mentioned, it's socialism and immediate nationalization of all industry, and then retooling it towards, first of all, degrowth on one side, and then the other side, retooling towards green energy, trying to immediately stop or greatly curtail and reduce emissions of everything that would require it. But the main issue is that this is very wishful thinking. Mm-hmm. This requires a global revolution and this is sadly not what's going to happen. What most likely will happen is we're going to end up going down this route of midline climate catastrophe, where it's not going to be the absolute worst that it could be, but it's not going to be nearly as good as it should be. And the only reason it's not going to be the absolute worst isn't because of some goodwill of cores of capital or something like that. It's going to be because of the massive efforts that China's carrying out in retooling their industry towards green energy, and because of how much of a percentage of global manufacture production of all kinds that they have, that retooling will essentially kind of in a weird way mitigate the greatest and most sharp edges of climate change. That doesn't mean that's still not going to fucking suck. It doesn't mean that there's going to be hundreds of millions of climate refugees and all the, all the catastrophic results of this. But I think the TLDR of this is that the solution won't come now. The solution will only be reached at after the consequences of climate change have already taken place. Mm-hmm. The sharpening of the contradictions that will result as a will happen as a result of this, the failing of meeting the challenges of climate change. This is what will eventually allow us to at least somewhat reorient.
As they say, I don't know who fucking said it, but the argument against the coming climate change could bring about socialism, but unfortunately, likely, the consequences of climate change might be the point which could bring about eventually socialism. Basically, we're so dumb we need to get bitten up the ass in order to realize that, holy fucking shit, this could get worse. My favorite point from all the brilliant stuff you said is that it rarely people think about it, that it's not just going to stop at 3-4. It's going to keep going and keep going and keep going. So we might be fucked, and it's going to get to 3-4, but it's up to us to utilize the absolute insane chaos that at that point, absolutely every human being on planet Earth will have reached a slap in their face, to use the fact that they now know what it is to be slapped, to tell them, we need to implement this and this and this if you don't want to get punched next time and then kicked. Mm. And then at one point you're fucking burning in your house, right? So kind of pessimistic optimism. I don't know. As Hakeem said, this will massively show the ever accumulating contradictions of the market economy that we exist in, and hopefully we will realize that before the contradictions get too piled up for us to be able to even live a relatively decent life. Hopefully we wake up while the lawn is burning and not while we're on the third floor. We're two floors down. You can't even jump off of the third floor at that point, okay? So, and the lawn is already burning. That's the most fucked up part. So, most likely we're going to be jumping from second floor, yeah.
I feel like the lawn's already burning and it's creeping its way into the house.
The car's on fire. But you have that annoying uncle in the, you're sitting on the second floor and he's like, oh, this is typical. Back in my day, we had lawn burnings all the time. Look, it's snowing above the burning lawn. Oh, look, I have a snowball. Catch.
Well, there we go. I think we've solved climate change, everyone. And it only took an hour, so...
Hey,
easy, I can't wait for comments. These guys said that climate change should happen so we can get socialism. It is not I'm already hearing Hakeem, I'm replacing it. I'm hearing the liberals in the walls. It's obviously not,
it's a huge, massive topic. The probably the biggest problem humanity has ever faced. So it stands to reason that none of us have the solutions. We don't have a roadmap to get out of this unscathed. That's probably not possible. Our roads have buckled due to the heat.
Yeah.
I think bottom line, humans will do the best that we can, as we've always done. There will be elements that will try to prevent that from happening. There will be elements that are incredibly dedicated to leaving a livable future. So I think we'll just have to, you know, we'll cast our lot with the ones we believe are correct, on the right side of history, on the right moral path. Do everything we can to make the others stumble, and we'll get through this. We'll see how it goes.
Allah.
There we go.
No, I was just gonna say, and we'll all be brought to trial before the creator of all of this.
I'm sorry, Tyler, the creator.
not specifically, but yeah, some people will get a very stern talking to. Let's just say that much.
Well, let's call it there. We can't solve anything else today, I imagine. Charlie, thank you so much for coming on. This has been a blast. Please tell our audience where they can find you. If you've got a Patreon, plug it. If you've got a cool project you're working on, plug it. Or if you've got any book recommendations, let them know.
Yeah. So you can find me at Our Changing Climate on YouTube. My Patreon is also Our Changing Climate. You can support me there. And honestly, books, there are so many good books you can read out there. I'd recommend Fossil Capital by Andreas Malm. I feel like that's a good thick book about why the hell we're in this crisis in the first place. Mm-hmm. And also books like Red Deal and A People's Green New Deal are interesting books about like kind of how the hell we get out of this crisis. You can watch some of my videos and I reference a ton of books, but yeah, those are some good starting points if you're interested in learning more.
Absolutely. Yeah, highly recommend Fossil Capital. I gave that to my brother as a Christmas gift. He works at Exxon, so I hope he reads it.
I'd be very curious to see what he thinks about it.
Oh my God, I'm sure he hasn't touched it, but I tried. I gave it my best shot.
Yeah.
I have a confession. I almost, straight out of college, I almost worked for Gazprom. They took me.
Yeah.
Imagine the alternate timeline of my existence. Wow. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. Changing Climate. Brilliant channel, genuinely.
All right. With all that being said, this has been The Deprogram. I'm JT.
I'm Hakim.
I'm Yugopnik.
And I'm Charlie.
From the Chocolate Factory. Oh, I'm 12.
You've been sitting on that the whole episode.
Yeah, bro. Yeah.